Today's podcast is brought to you by our friends at Bandzoogle. Built by musicians for musicians, Bandzoogle is an all-in-one platform that makes it easy to build a stunning website and EPK for your music. All the features you need for a professional website are already built in, including dozens of fully customizable templates, tools to sell your music and merch commission-free, commission-free crowdfunding and fan subscription features, mailing list tools to grow your fan lists and send newsletters, integrations with Bandcamp, SoundCloud, YouTube, Bands in Town, and more, so you can easily add content from your other online profiles, and live support from their musician-friendly team 7 days a week. Plans start at just $8.29 a month, which includes hosting and your own free custom domain name. How to Build a Sustainable Music Career and Collect All Revenue Streams podcast listeners can go to bandzoogle.com to try it free for 30 days and use the promo code SUSTAINABLE to get 15% off the first year of any subscription. That's bandzoogle.com, promo code SUSTAINABLE, caps, no caps, it all works for the promo code. I just want to say, on a personal level, I've known the Bandzoogle team for a long time. They are great humans. They are always working super hard. And I run into them in non-pandemic times at conferences. I run into them in pandemic times at conferences. They're always networking. They're always connecting. And they're always on top of updating their platform for you to make sure they are integrating with everyone. I also personally love how they have their mailing list tools integrated, as that is really the foundation of building a sustainable music career and a huge element of what we're going to talk about on today's podcast. So head over to bandzoogle.com and use the promo code SUSTAINABLE for 15% off the first year of any subscription. Hello, welcome to episode 11 of How to Build a Sustainable Music Career and Collect All Revenue Streams. I'm your host, Emily White. Today is the first episode of three episodes that have basically the same title, except different guests and an evolving concept. So today's episode is setting up your release and distribution plan with Bandcamp founder Ethan Diamond. So the next two episodes are also going to be setting up your release and distribution plan. Today we're talking about direct to fan and how that is so important and fundamentally how you build a sustainable music career. And then next week, we're going to be talking about DistroKid and TuneCore and CD Baby, which in the music industry are called aggregators, but in reality, they're essentially digital music distributors. And then the episode after that, I'll be talking to Symphonix GM, Nick Gordon, and they are a digital distributor, except they don't accept everyone. So I'm trying to kind of take you through the steps and stages of literally setting up your release and distribution plan, which is chapter 6 in the book. Chapter 6 encompasses all three of these episodes. But in the meantime, before we get to interviewing Bandcamp founder Ethan Diamond, I just wanted to cover a few things. No pun intended, because my first thing is about song covers. I probably should have mentioned this in the business affairs episode. This is where information on uncovering songs goes, but it's, you know, either way, if you're going to release a cover, you need to take care of the business affairs on that before you distribute it. So it technically works in this chapter too, or chapter as well. So if you are doing a cover song, you are going to want to head to Harry Fox's website so you can purchase what is called a mechanical license. The current statutory rate for a mechanical license is, I believe, is 9.1 cents. So in iTunes and basically the, you know, digital download era and prior, you would have to pay 9.1 cent to the songwriters of the song you're covering every time you sell that song. Now you can purchase an estimated amount of streams from Harry Fox. And Harry Fox is most likely going to handle the mechanical royalties for the artist you are covering. But if not, look up who their music publisher is and reach out. Most music publishers have a portal on their site where you can purchase a mechanical license that helps you to estimate streams. If I mean, literally, like what I just described is going to work like 98% of the time. But in the 2% of the time that you are covering a song that Harry Fox does not issue mechanical licenses for, and you cannot find a portal on the publisher's site for the artists you are contacting, just reach out to them directly and see if you can purchase a mechanical license. I don't think you'll have to take it that far. But anyone can cover anything on the recording side. Just a quick reminder, there's two rights in music, the recorded music side and then the songwriting or music publishing side. Anyone can record a cover, but everyone has to pay mechanicals to songwriters on songs they cover. So get that taken care of before you release any sort of cover. Okay, and one last thing before I dig in on direct to fan and its importance. This podcast has been charting in 15 countries. It's charting in two more countries this week, Serbia and Saudi Arabia. So shout out to listeners there. And really, thanks to all of you for listening, supporting. It's been awesome to hear from you on social media. And keep it up, because I don't know who you are, because podcasting is going to have its own direct-to-fan revolution at some point, but one step at a time. And, you know, hopefully podcasting and other industries can learn from the music industry, because we've really been at the forefront of direct-to-fan and direct-to-consumer. So let me explain what that is and why it's important. I'm sure I've said this on the podcast before. I say it all the time to students and in speaking engagements. The most valuable companies in the world are tech companies. Why? Because they have our data. And that is something that we, you know, data, user data is something that we just freely give up as musicians and music industry creators. Starting in the MySpace era, you know, iTunes era, you know, Spotify, like, there's no way to reach out to your fans on Spotify directly and say hello. And so what started to happen in 2008-ish is that the technology, you know, got to a point where artists could communicate with their fans, which was really, really exciting. And I think, you know, oh, and then the other, you know, well, I'll get to this. But the other cool component of direct-to-fan is not limiting yourself to, you know, streaming royalties or, I'm dating myself, but iTunes, you know, to 99 cents a song or $9.99 an album. And to exemplify that, I was managing the Dresden Dolls and Amanda Palmer in, I mean, I did for a while, but this was 2007. And This was an era technologically where friends of, you know, everyone was like instant messaging, you know, zip files of albums back and forth. And I was at a show with Amanda. I can't remember if it was Amanda or the Dresden Dolls, but it was at the Middle East in Boston. And I was sitting at the merch table and I saw someone come up to Amanda and offer her a check for like, or just give her a check for like $300 and say, I just want to support you and I just want to support your art. And at the time, Amanda was recording her first solo album, which was produced by Ben Folds. And I remember thinking, and again, this was the iTunes era. So people were buying, you know, songs for 99 cents and albums for $9.99 on iTunes. And I just remember thinking, like, why can't we post Amanda's album as a zip file, since that's what I'm sending back and forth with friends and countless other people are doing the same. Why can't we just post a zip file and have it be a suggested donation? You know, just like a museum. Like, why are we limiting fans to $9.99 for album or 99 cents per song? And so I wrote a kind of a business plan, and I was working at a management company at the time, and I presented it to my two bosses, and one of them was like, this is great. Let's get on a call. Let's figure this out. I should preface this by saying I knew the label would never let us do this, but it just made a lot of sense to me for a lot of reasons. And so again, I was really fortunate to have a forward-thinking boss and mentor who was like, this is great. Let's get on a call. My other boss is like, this will never work. Go back to working on your artists. And I was working on it kind of in my spare time with some computer developer friends. And even though I knew the label would never let us do it. And I remember I was going to bed one night and dating myself further, I looked at my BlackBerry and Bob Lefsetz, who many of you know is like an industry blogger, sent out an email that said, you know, to his list, not to me, that said, click this, which probably no one would do now. That just sounds like, you know, spam or some sort of bad situation. But it was Radiohead's In Rainbows album. And for those of you that don't know or were too young or whatever, Radiohead just put out an album in whenever this was, 2007, 2008 or whatever. And it was the exact same concept. It was pay what you want. It was suggested donation. And that was, you know, transformational. That was the biggest story in the music industry. And I went into work the next day and my naysaying boss, who I do love, you know, his favorite, one of his, I won't say his favorite band is Radiohead, but whatever. He would sing a lot of Radiohead in the office. He was like, Radiohead stole your idea. So that, like, that was his way of kind of validating, like, oh, wow, maybe that was a pretty good idea. And I'm sure there were other people that thought of it besides Radiohead. I think there was like a jazz guy that was doing it, you know, so, you know, when there's a good and practical idea, it's not usually one person that has it. And yeah, so Radiohead really cracked open the direct-to-fan revolution. Again, like, why are we limiting fans to, you know, 99 cents or streaming royalties or whatever? And then also the power of data. And there was a huge movement and, you know, dare I say revolution kind of around that time that lasted a few years and is still going on today as far as, you know, basically direct-to-fan presentations, right? Like, remember Topspin? For those that remember, Topspin was one of the first direct-to-fan companies, and they would go around and, you know, present to artists and managers being like, you can know which fan pays the most. You can know where your fans are, right? So it was really sharing the power of data. And then again, I keep saying it, but just not limiting yourself to finite price points. I was fortunate to be on the board of Cash Music, who developed free open source direct-to-fan tools for artists. They are referenced in the book, and unfortunately, they no longer exist. So there is a link in the book where I'm going to post updates because I figured things like that would happen. Unfortunately, there are some issues with my publisher, which I won't get into, but I really just want this URL back. But I'm kind of alluding to that because that's kind of the whole point of this episode, right? Like, I didn't even listen to my own advice. It's like, oh, I'm close with my publisher. Like, I'll use their URL to post updates. And, you know, he's been going through a hard time and I just haven't heard back from him. And now I have a dead link in my book, right? So that's a long-winded story to say your website is the ultimate direct-to-fan. It's the ultimate direct-to-consumer. That's where you're going to get an A-plus from me. You should be selling all your music digitally on your website. I really like Squarespace for websites. I sell books, you know, through our Squarespace website. I can't code. I can figure out a Squarespace website. It's great if you can have a donation option, you know, so you're not limiting yourself, like I said, to finite prices on your website. And again, you know who those fans are. And like, not to be a creep, but like, you know, a lot of you have kindly bought the book that this podcast is based on from my company's website. And like, I know who you are and you totally fascinate me, right? There's professors, there's major managers, there's artists from all over the world. So I promise I'm not too creepy, but it's so fascinating to see, you know, what types of people are checking out this information and hopefully that they're finding it useful. As opposed to this podcast that has thousands of listeners. And again, I have no idea who you are. And almost every day, a friend or a colleague was like, oh, I checked out this podcast episode. And I get really excited when I hear that. But I'm always surprised, right? Because I have no idea who they are because Spotify and Apple Music, just like for musicians, owns all that data, right? And data is absolutely power. So the A-plus version from me for direct-to-fan is to be selling all of your music digitally on your site for a And then also have a donation option if people want to pay more than that. But one thing I also talk about in the book is monetizing your music from day one. So you can do this in a few ways. If you have a set vision for your release, launch a pre-order as soon as you begin recording. I probably should have talked about that during the recording chapter, but I know I do in the book. So, you know, when you're launching a pre-order or a fundraiser or whatever you want to call it, I like pre-order. If you have a set vision, you want to have a price point for everyone. You know, maybe everybody gets the, you know, say it's an album. Maybe everybody gets the album digitally for $5. Maybe they get a CD for 10, vinyl for 20 or 25. And then you want to make the tiers more enticing as they go. I remember, again, kind of in this direct-to-fan era, Arcade Fire came out with a release and I was like totally fine to buy the $10 digital or whatever. And then suddenly I'm spending $100 on a really compelling package because each tier got more attractive. So you want to monetize your music from day one, as far as that goes. If you don't have a clear vision for your release, if you're just, you know, hitting the home studio and figuring it out, launch a Patreon. And that way you can keep fans engaged and bring them along as a part of your journey as you begin recording. So start monetizing from day one. That's what I did with this, again, the book that this podcast is based on, which is my second book. I launched a pre-order when I was halfway done writing it because I knew I would finish it. And I ended up recouping the expenses on the book before release. So I think recouping before release is a really great mindset and model to be in that I'd love people thinking about more and kind of having that mentality if possible. Don't just wait until the release is out and be like, okay, it's on Spotify, like go collect pennies. You know, start. I've been monetizing this project for 3 years, which I feel weird saying because I didn't like write a 3-year plan for this entire project, but I was shocked when, you know, it came up on Facebook that I was presenting on how to build a sustainable music career and collect all revenue streams 2 years ago. So I did basically a year of pre-orders in 2019. And anytime someone would ask me to speak, I would just present on the topics and people could pre-order the book. I spent all of 2020 releasing the book, as well as producing the largest digital webcast in history, which is on my mind. It's called I Voted. It's on my mind because I've been doing a lot of fundraising for that lately. And then I launched this podcast in 2021. So that's 3 years of one project. And I'm just amazed that it keeps going. So again, don't just wait until, you know, your baby is out. Start monetizing your release from day one. And, you know, doing that through direct to fan, direct to consumer, through your website is ideal. Now, if doing any sort of commerce through your Squarespace website or whatever site you're using, but I like Squarespace just because you can easily update it, or people who can't code like me can fairly easily update it. But if you're like, oh my gosh, this is torture, it's, you know, Squarespace is not intuitive to me, you need to be on Bandcamp as well, which I'll talk about in a second, but you can embed your releases from Bandcamp onto your site. So that technology, as far as selling your music directly and getting that data, will be taken care of for you. However, Bandcamp takes a commission. It's a fairly reasonable commission of, I believe, 15%. But so that's why selling music directly through your website is the best way to support you financially as far as the highest profit margin goes and collecting data for your long-term and sustainable use. I cannot stress that enough. That's how you connect directly with your audience, is through email addresses, through text messages, because again, all these platforms just continually constantly change. If you built your career on MySpace, you know, again, you don't own that page. A lot of people just lost master recordings that were all hung up in MySpace, or maybe I saw they got them back, but you get the idea. You know, I used to say for years, like, I know it's hard to believe that like Facebook may no longer exist. And now it's like, well, a lot of people don't like Facebook and maybe it'll be regulated or broken up or whatever. So the things that seem really ingrained right now are just going to shift and evolve. That's just the reality when it comes to technology as well as the music industry. So again, ideally you want to launch your pre-order from your website, probably a few episodes and chapters ago. I apologize for that. And then you also want to be on Bandcamp. And I've been really obsessed with Bandcamp literally from day one. As you hear, it's another platform. Not that there's that many that I've been an evangelist for, but another platform that I've just been a totally authentic, organic, unpaid evangelist for, because I really believe in what they're doing. They genuinely empower artists by, again, not limiting price points to, you know, fractions of a cent for streaming, as well as, again, limiting it to 99 cents or whatever in the iTunes era, you know, per song. And they give, and, you know, that's awesome. And then, but possibly more valuable and more important is that they give you the data of your fans. If the fan opts in, so there's no like privacy issue there, which is what the tech companies will say, oh, they're protecting their user privacy. It's like, give me a break. What fan doesn't want to like hear directly from their private art or from their favorite artist, and they can opt out from there. And again, the power of that is all these things are going to change, right? Like maybe you're signed to a label, maybe you're with a manager, maybe everything's amazing, but what happens if that label falls apart? God forbid your manager dies. You know, like anything could happen. And all you have is your great art and your audience. That's the whole point of promo and all this other stuff we're going to get into in the future. Like, I think that promo can kind of be a jumbled mess in the modern era, because back in the day, you know, you could be in like Spin magazine and you're going to sell CDs, you're going to sell music. Now, that's not necessarily the case in a world of infinite media, right? So anyway, my point is on that, which we'll get more into in future episodes, is the whole point of promotion was to get fans. And now you can get fans directly, which again, we'll talk about in future episodes, but you can communicate with them directly. And so what that means is no matter what's going on, you know, with your team or technology or whatever, like, I've told this story a million times. I started working with the Dresden Dolls as an intern when I was in college. And this was 2002 or something, way before people were talking about email lists, direct to fan, blah, blah, blah. And Amanda had an email list, basically. Amanda Palmer of the Dresden Dolls had an email list for the band. I don't think we even had like email list software or anything at the time. It's probably just like a BCC thing. And that's how she would communicate with her audience about, you know, upcoming shows, releases, all that stuff. And Amanda said to me once, this is said with so much love. I've said it a million times, so I really hope it's not a negative thing, but I don't think she would have a problem with this. It was so brilliant that Amanda had that email list, but it also came out of paranoia. Because she said to me at one point, this was early days in the band, but they may have had it, they had a few team members in place. And she's like, well, what if you go away? What if my fancy booking agent goes away? What if my attorney goes away? This is all I have to share my art with my audience, is this email list. So I really hope you understand the power of direct to fan. Amanda went on to raise the most money ever for a musician on Kickstarter, over $1 million. And she did so because the Dresden Dolls, well, she makes great art and she has an amazing connection with her audience. But fundamentally, she and Brian Biglione of the Dresden Dolls worked, and myself, worked our butts off to collect as many email addresses as possible over the years with that band. I think they have like 100,000 person email list. And actually, back to the, Radiohead, Amanda, the name your own price business plan I was making. Radiohead beat us to it. Again, the label would never let us do it. And I remember when that album, when Amanda's solo album came out, it sold 10,000 copies in the first week. 9,000 were through Amanda and the Dresden Dolls email list, and 1,000 were by the label, who had one job. Also, we'd built in some pretty high, you know, some pretty enticing bundles in that release through Amanda's email list and website, and we easily cleared six figures, and Amanda was able to keep the vast majority of it, and then the label kept their share of, you know, what they sold because we were able to sell directly and keep all that, which is amazing. So that's the power of direct-to-fan. You should be doing it through your website. You should also be doing it through Bandcamp. Ideally, you start by pushing out the website. Maybe a week later, then you share, you know, Bandcamp. And that's ultimately what I want to cover today. You know, like pre-order, website, Bandcamp. This is where you make the vast majority of your money on recording, or where you can really go wild here. And then in the next episode, like I said, we're going to talk about distributing your music to Spotify, Apple, all that good stuff. But it's a step-by-step process for a reason, so it helps you. And I hope that covers it with direct to fan. You know, definitely hit me up. I'm at mwizzle on Twitter. This is something I'm extremely passionate about as far as sustainability for not just artists, but all talent for the long term. I had a major athlete's family member reach out to me this week asking about direct to fan, direct to consumer, you know, for his family member. And yeah, so, you know, direct to consumer is, you know, quote, commerce. I know it's kind of a dirty word, like in our world, is something that they're definitely talking about, you know, in all industries. And it's something that music has been at the forefront of. And I will give my publisher credit for this. George Howard, love you. You know, he's always said that music is the canary in the coal mine for other fields. And I feel that, you know, and that's, you know, definitely the case with direct to fan. You know, music went first. And I think that's because our file formats are smaller. Like, it's much easier to share an MP3 with someone than it is a television show file or a film or whatever. So we've really broken the mold, for better or for worse. You know, before Netflix came along, like I said, you know, streaming and TV shows and films and all that. So hopefully the podcast industry can learn from that. I think that's going to be a reckoning at some point, that's for sure. And yeah, no matter what you're doing, there's so, you know, that's the power of the internet. That's what was so exciting when kind of the consumer internet came out to, you know, that was exciting to countless people, but it's people like me, Jesse Von Doom, Amanda Palmer, you know, it was just like, oh my gosh, we can go direct. We're not just beholden to, you know, massive tech corporations. Those things exist and there's ways to utilize and monetize the massive tech corporations, but this is where it's at for the long term. So again, I hope that gives you a good foundation of direct to fan. And now I am going to hand it over to myself where I interview Bandcamp founder Ethan Diamond. So I hope you enjoy it and tune in next week where we're going to be talking about the same topic, setting up your release and distribution plan. And we're going to be talking about DistroKid, TuneCore, CD Baby, and the differences between those. So thank you so much for listening. Spread the word. Let me know if you have questions or anything. And in the meantime, enjoy my interview with Ethan.
Welcome to How to Build a Sustainable Music Career and Collect All Revenue Streams. I'm your host, Emily White. Today, I'm so thrilled to have Bandcamp founder Ethan Diamond for episode 11, Setting Up Your Release and Distribution Plan. Welcome, Ethan.
Hi, thank you.
So I initially connected with you in 2008, and it was kind of a weird story on my end. I had just started my first company. I was managing and consulting on artists. And we were definitely looking for, whether we realized it was called this or not, like a direct-to-fan solution. You know, maybe, I'm sure there were technical people that existed that could help us do this on artists' websites. But I was managing Amanda Palmer at the time, and I was talking to someone at her label, and he had suggested a website that sounded really interesting, and I couldn't remember what it was called. So I just started Googling, and I found you guys, and I thought that's what Harlan from the label had mentioned. It turned out it was something totally different, and I reached out to you. So tell us about the origins of Bandcamp. Why did you found it?
Sure. Well, let's see. It was 2007, and there was an artist that I really loved who had decided that they were going to put out their next record on their own. And they did that. And I went to their website on the day the record came out, and the site didn't even load. So I just thought, they're probably overwhelmed with traffic. That happens a lot. I'll check back the next day. And I did that, and it loaded really slowly. But it eventually got there. And, you know, this was at the time where the trend in websites was everything was Flash-based, and you kind of had to poke around a little bit to figure out, like, what exactly the interface did. It was, where the players were and things like that, how to just listen to the music. And so, you know, I listened to a snippet of the record, paid for it, and then nothing happened. You know, I didn't get the record. And so I wrote to, there are a few different like help links on the site. And I wrote to one of those saying, hey, you know, I paid for this record, didn't get it. I got a message back. I think it was from the lead singer, and it was just a link to an open zip file. And, obviously, you know, could have shared around. I didn't do that, of course, but, I open it up, and all of the tracks on this record, all of the files inside the zip file were, they had names like master3.mp3, and they were, you know, like low quality MP3s, no context around it at all. Basically every sort of technical hurdle that you could run into getting this record, I hit. And I knew that as a result of that, I think, you know, very few people probably ended up hearing this record, which just, you know, it killed me for two reasons. One was that I just really love the band. I thought they deserved, you know, all the success in the world. And, you know, when you love a band, right, you want everybody else to hear it too and have that similar reaction to you. So that was, just made me sad. And the other part of it was that I just really admired what the band was trying to do, because, you know, obviously the internet makes it possible, to go, directly to your fans with your music and have that sort of direct interaction with your fans I admired that. I wanted that to be possible and felt like they shouldn't be running into technical hurdles like this. You know, somebody should do something to help not only, you know, this band, but any band really who wants to do it this way. And again, you know, this was 2007, 2008, where the options just didn't exist for something like that. There was MySpace, and they had, there was a plugin at the time called Snowcap that let you sell your music, but it was pretty difficult to use. And, you know, MySpace obviously was really somebody else's site. It was the MySpace identity and had a bunch of advertising on it and all that. And it was just, it was really weird to me that at that time, if you were a writer, you had WordPress and Blogger and Movable Type and all these things that kind of let you set up a site very quickly and easily for free. And then, you know, the branding of Movable Type or Blogger or whatever was just a little blurb in the footer. So it was really, you know, it was possible to create your own identity like that. But if, you know, your artistic output was music instead of words, you didn't have an option like that. So that was really the basic idea, was like, let's create this essentially a white label service for artists that would let you sell your music directly to your fans. And if anything, you know, we wanted to be as far in the background as possible, you know, and let somebody have their own URL and just say, you know, powered by Bandcamp at the bottom. So, you know, that's what we did. And at first people thought, I think we were pretty crazy, because the conventional wisdom at that point was that music sales were dead. Piracy had eliminated that. And my feeling was that if you just gave people an obvious way to directly support, you know, a musician they love, that they would take you up on that. So the most exciting proof of that we got in the early days was that we were looking at, for every sale that was coming through, we were looking to see, you know, how the person got to Bandcamp. And a lot of the search terms that were coming in were for things like the name of an album or the name of a track, plus the word like LimeWire or Hulkshare or Torrent, right? So people who like were setting out at the beginning, maybe not to pirate music, but just to get it in the easiest way possible. And that's was their mindset. But they ended up on Bandcamp, saw, you know, that they could get this directly from the artist and then did that. And that was, you know, that was extremely exciting because it really just validated a bunch of the assumptions that we were going in with. And, you know, from that point forward, it just, grew and grew.
I love it. Who was that first artist that really sparked? Oh,
you know, I don't want to call them out, but, you know, because it's kind of the point of this is that, you know, yeah, it was this one artist for me, but at the time it was, you know, thousands of or tens of thousands of artists. It was any artist really who wanted to go this route was running into that problem where they were just spending, you know, lots of money and lots of time and ending up with something that didn't, you know, necessarily work. And like that, it just, it made no sense.
Do they know that they inspired Bandcamp?
No, I don't know. I'm not sure. You know, I still see that band to this day every once in a while, but I don't know that they, I haven't mentioned it because I'm still starstruck when I, even though it's, you know, a small independent band, I'm like, you know, I'm a total fan. So I never have said anything to them.
I love it. But because like you said, it wasn't their fault and they were doing things right. They were trying. They just didn't have the tools and the technology to do it.
Totally. Yep. That's right.
Are you, you're a musician, right?
Oh, no, I wouldn't say so. I grew up playing music. I play saxophone in jazz band and then like horn sections and funk bands and stuff through college, but I haven't played in a while. I'm much more of a music fan, these days.
Cool. So you kind of talked about this, but like, you know, when you realized there was that problem and then you realized you could solve it, like what was your vision for Bandcamp when you began? Was it just like, I just want to help artists I love? I mean, obviously it's so huge now. So what was that vision in, you know, 2008, even 2009?
Well, the earliest vision I'd say was just to help artists be successful and, you know, help them go directly to their fans and create that relationship because I feel like it's a mutually beneficial one. Like I, as a fan, get to participate in the creation of more of the art that I love. And that, you know, that feels good. That makes me feel more connected to the music. And then obviously from the artist's perspective, it allows the artist to continue making music, right? And that, I would say that was really the extent of it. It was really just to kind of sit back and empower a bunch of artists in this way. And we didn't, at least in the earliest days, I didn't have this idea that Bandcamp would end up being a community that that drives a lot of the sales. So that was one of the earliest sort of changes that happened, but it took years. You know, the company's been around for 12 years now, and I don't think it was until like year three or four that people, you know, when people would ask me, hey, you know, what are some other math rock artists on this platform? And I would, my first reaction was, I don't, you know, why are you asking? Why do you care? You know, use Google, right? Totally. To rock into Google. And then I started as enough artists got on the platform and there was sort of this critical mass was hit. It started to make sense that somebody would ask that question because they were really asking about, you know, the idea that, that they want to find other artists to directly support in this way, others in this scene, and you know, artists really recommending other artists became something that we realized we could do. You know, and it sounds ridiculous, I know, but I at the time, that my point of comparison was MySpace, and the community on MySpace had really over time devolved into something that I thought of as a distraction. You know, on people's pages, people were writing like, thanks for the ad, and then posting each other's flyers constantly and kind of spamming each other's pages. And I thought, oh, you know, let's just create no community whatsoever on this. Right? Let's have it just be about the artist. But then, you know, once we did hit that number, I don't know what it was, but at some point there were enough artists where it was like, yeah, you know what? having the ability to recommend other artists could be really powerful, or having the ability to search through here could be really interesting. And, you know, part of the inspiration for that was Fader magazine has a section at the front where an artist, they would pick an artist and then ask that artist to name like three records that, you know, changed their life or were most influential to them. And I realized, you know, we could make like a little digital version of this, right? Where any artist on Bandcamp, after you purchase their music, could tell you about, you know, three other artists on the site that they think you should go check out. And so we implemented that, and that started to do, you know, we saw the power of that. People were using that. And then we just expanded that over time. So now there's, you know, a footer at the bottom of pages where those recommendations appear, and you know, you can explore other fans' collections of the music they've bought. And, you know, that again was something where, you know, the reference points I had, you know, at the time were things like social networks telling you what other people you followed were listening to. And, you know, because they were frictionless, it was, I thought, meaningless. But because what we were doing was, you know, creating friction, that in terms of like a purchase of music, you know, that the fact that the person spent money to buy that music made that collection much more meaningful. So seeing what other people bought, we thought, hey, that may be a really interesting way to discover new music. So we implemented that. And again, you know, saw just a ton of people using it and driving a lot of sales for artists. And, you know, slowly just Bandcamp evolved into being that community that it is now, where, you know, that instead of, you know, just being a bunch of individual artist sort of sites or islands, it's this community that creates a lot of the sales for those artists.
Amazing. How did artists get involved with Bandcamp in the early days? Were you proactively reaching out? Was it random people like me, like Googling by accident? How did you get artists on the platform initially?
Yeah, well, we've never done any marketing of the site. In the early days, Andy Bayo from the XOXO Festival, who had a site called Upcoming in around the time Bandcamp started, which was for upcoming events. He's somebody that I connected with in those days, and he wrote an article about Bandcamp when we launched. And his followers, you know, I would say are a lot of the, you know, sort of internet culture, internet musicians. So in those earliest days, I think, right, like after that article was published, you know, a lot of people who made video game music came to the site. A lot of people from like, you know, like there was a choose your own adventure online. I don't even know how to describe it, but it was basically a choose your own adventure that had a music soundtrack.
Cool.
And then there was the furry community and the music that they love. So it was all of these sort of outsider communities that were really interesting found it at first. But also, you know, I approached friends of mine in San Francisco who, you know, San Francisco in 2008, still there were a lot of musicians still here. And they, you know, people, it would just spread by word of mouth almost exclusively. And you know, that had its advantages and disadvantages. I mean, I loved the purity, I guess, of that. You know, it wasn't anybody that we recruited really to the site. But by starting from this, point of the platform's going to be completely open, that was beautiful in some way, but also it created a hurdle from the earliest days where, you know, if you were a bigger artist, there was a perception that, you know, Bandcamp was maybe just for amateurs. And, you know, we have just, I think, fought to overcome that over time. And I think now we have, but it was definitely a challenge early on. But to me, that was the kind of the point of Bandcamp, is that it could be open to absolutely everybody. It should be as direct as possible. You can just go set up your site, upload your music. You don't have to wait for, you know, a distributor to get it there, and somebody pays you and you get the money immediately, right? It's as transparent as can be. And but again, like that created some, I think, head scratching moments for other artists where it was like, do I really want my music to be up there, you know, where I'm next to, like, you know, the music of an 11-year-old who just, you know, is uploading their first music from their parents' basement or whatever. It's just, and I now the answer is, you know, it doesn't matter, right? I think it's, of course, it can be anything, right? So I like that about it.
And like that's the case with distributing music anywhere. An 11-year-old can distribute to Spotify. And I've been fighting that fight for you guys for a long time because it's really confused me, especially when we have artists on labels. And, you know, I ask, if we can have the album on Bandcamp, and the answer is no, or, you know, so how much money has been paid out roughly to rights holders and artists since you guys began?
It's now just shy of 700 million.
Yeah. So then I make that point to labels whose job legally is to promote and exploit in the legal sense, the master, and collect as much money as possible. And now they're finally paying attention. But obviously the other component is, you know, the data that you give to artists and rights holders, which I would say is as valuable as that 700 million, if not more. But before we get into that, you know, you talked about word of mouth being key to growth, but, you know, what were other tipping points or key turning points that stand out to you as far as growth goes in those early days?
Sure. Well, there are two. Actually three I want to tell you about. So the first one was when we added physical goods to the site. So at first, Bandcamp was just about selling digital music to fans. And after a couple of years, we allowed you to attach a physical album to a digital purchase, so you could get, you know, a vinyl record or CD and immediately have the digital in your collection. And then we enabled just adding standalone merchandise. And, you know, our model, by the way, is essentially the Etsy model. We're a marketplace, right? So we don't manufacture or fulfill the merchandise, but we're a marketplace for it, right? But once we created the ability to add physical goods as, you know, their standalone thing, like, you know, here is my t-shirt, here's my vinyl record, or as part of the album, you know, that was sort of an immediate bump that I think increased the business something like 40%. Immediately. And the next one was adding the ability for a label to sign up and have, you know, artists point to different artist sites. And all the things that we needed to do around that, like allowing an artist to have some records where the payments go to them and then other records where the payments go to the label, and showing unified stats for those artists. So we didn't really start off with the idea that, you know, labels are bad or anything like that. It's just we were four people at the beginning. All and right. we couldn't implement everything that we wanted to do. So I think that caused some people to wonder, like, well, is Bandcamp, you know, just for artists only? But now, you know, there are 9,000 independent labels on the site, and they generate, you know, a really significant percentage of the business overall. So that was another moment where things kind of changed. And then the other one was about 6 years ago, 5 years ago, when we launched our editorial publication, the Bandcamp Daily, and that's just been enormous for us. You know, we have just an incredibly talented group of editors and writers whose mission essentially is to go find, you know, this incredible sort of variety of music that's on the site. Go find the stuff that they want to highlight and call people's attention to, and that again was something that not only I think made the site a whole lot more interesting, but also motivated a lot of labels and artists who might be sort of constantly thinking about, you know, the next album and the PR cycle for that, to actually get involved with Bandcamp. And so that's been just really effective too.
Awesome. So at your core, you know, I meet students all the time. I meet young musicians, I meet older musicians, who don't know about Bandcamp, and I'm constantly preaching the importance. So at a basic core level, why should artists and really any rights holder, you know, we'll include labels in this as well, work with Bandcamp?
Sure. I mean, because there's a really large audience of music buyers and passionate music consumers on Bandcamp now. You know, there are millions of fans who every month, now it's about $21 million that is being spent. There's about 70,000 records sold a day on the site. And, you know, you can upload your music and be a part of that in a matter of, you know, minutes. So why wouldn't you?
Exactly. And why is it important to you to share fan/customer data with artists and rights holders, as well as not limit price points?
Sure. Well, I mean, because I view the data as belonging to the artist or label. It's not ours. I mean, it's ours in the sense that, like, it's the labels and artists and Bandcamps to use in as effectively as possible to sell more music and help those artists and labels more. So I feel like, you know, we use the data to bring the artist and label more fans, and the label and artist should be able to do that too. So I don't think it really ever occurred to me that it wasn't the artist and label's data. It's like, of course it is. It should be. But I think the sensitivity around that for others is, you know, about, you know, wanting, really starting with this sort of fan first mentality, wanting to protect all of the data of the fan and respect that. And we respect that too. It's everything that we do is opt-in through the fan. But if a fan wants to share their email address with a band because they love that band and want to know when the band is selling something new or coming to their town to do a show or something like that, of course you should let them do that, right? So I just feel like starting with that, like, artist first mentality that we've always had, is kind of what led to that. And, yeah. And by the way, you know, I didn't cover this earlier, but, you know, at our core, you know, we are, and this is another reason to, you know, to answer your question about, well, you know, why you should have your music up on the site. You know, above everything else, we're an artist first platform. You know, the whole business is structured in such a way that we prioritize the interests of the artists above anything. So, you know, the way Bandcamp works is it's, you know, it's not a subscription fee. It's not advertising. It's a revenue share based model. So when a sale happens, you know, there's a credit card processing fee, and then there's a Bandcamp fee, which, you know, averages out to about 11%. It's 10% on physical goods and then 15% on digital. And it drops to 10% after you've made $5,000 in a year. So the average across the whole site, the average that ends up going to the artist on any given transaction is about 82%. So, you know, Bandcamp only makes money when the artists and labels on the site make a bunch more money, right? So that is kind of always been, that alignment of interests has always been core to what we're about. And I think is yet another reason why, you know, why wouldn't you have your music here?
Absolutely. And, you know, protecting fans' data, that's kind of a cop-out because you explain it perfectly. It's like you're giving the fan the choice to opt in. And I'm going to guess that I want to share my data with my favorite artists. I want to hear from them directly. So that is so powerful and something I'm constantly educating people on. It's just really, really important and powerful. And along those same lines, why is it important to you to not limit price points?
Well, because I think that that the artist knows their audience a lot better than we could. You know, like there was an artist in the early days who I remember was selling their digital album for 13 euros or 18. No, it was 18 euros. And I would have never, you know, I don't know who their audience is or why that's the right price for them.
Sure.
But they did really, really well at that, you know, and it just always seemed to me like this idea that it should be this number, not that number. I think that the artist or label probably knows that better than we can. And what we can do though is look across the entire site at the pricing that seems to be most effective, and we make that a suggestion. You know, we just say, hey, this is what seems to work best across the site. You know, use this information as you will, but, you know, but again, it's completely up to you. And again, that's just, I think, from the mentality of like, it's not about us. It should be about the artist and what they want to do. The exception to that, I would say, is just that it's been really important to us from the early days to allow fans to pay more if they want to.
Yes.
So you on the site, you know, you can set a minimum price, you can set a floor for things, but we really encourage you to let fans pay more if they want, which people do a whole lot of the time. And, you know, it's just a way for a fan to express gratitude and end up having that connection with the artist that happens when they do that. So every day we see some, you know, examples of people paying like $100 for a $1 track, mm-hmm. because the music, you know, meant that much to them, or, you know, $100 for an album that was listed for $7 or $8. So I just think, you know, why wouldn't you enable that kind of magic to happen? It's great when it happens. And so we all have always wanted to enable it.
Absolutely. And I've never understood why would we limit fans to, like, you know, when you started, it was the iTunes era. So I would say, like, why would you limit fans to 99 cents or $9.99 for an album? And now, you know, with streaming, why would you limit it to that? I had an artist who put up some tracks on Bandcamp and included a drawing of a rhino for $1,000, and someone bought it. And I'm sure you have many examples of that. But if someone wants to give you $100 or $1,000, why would, along with their data, you know, so the artist can continue to communicate about music and shows and all that, why would we stop them? So,
for sure,
love that. I have an audience question from an artist named Culla. Does being private, does Bandcamp being a private company allow you to have better relationships with artists?
Well, I think, you know, the main benefit of being private is that it's allowed us to really control the direction of the company and continue to prioritize the interest of the artist over, shareholders. And I think there are examples of companies that actually manage to balance this really well. Etsy is one. It's a public company, I think, and really prioritizes the community. But, I haven't run a public company, so I haven't had that experience of how you end up balancing that. But, you know, it's not only staying private that's helped us in that way. It's that we're a profitable business. We focus really early on getting to profitability and not raising a ton of money. We raised money in the early days in 2007, 2008. We raised a small amount of money, but got to profitability in 2012 and just have stayed there ever since. And that's just that's allowed us to really control the direction of the business and stay true to our mission. And that's meant a lot to me.
I love that. Very cool. Did you ever imagine Bandcamp would be in the place that it is today?
You know, I don't know. I can't say I really thought a ton about, you know, about it. Every kind of moment of Bandcamp's existence has been like, ooh, what's this, you know, what's this next cool thing that we can do to help artists? And what are we going to do to keep, you know, growing the site and being a better service? And so the focus for me has always been, you know, on how to build this and what it should do. And along the way, I guess my assumption was, yeah, if this, you know, as soon as we saw it being useful for 100 people in the earliest days, it seems like, oh, we can make this, you know, useful for a lot more people than that. So let's keep evolving it and keep growing it and having more and more impact. And along the way, at some point it got to where it is today. But I can't say like there was ever a moment where he said, okay, our mission here is to, you know, be used by this many artists or have this many fans. It's incredibly gratifying, obviously, that it is at this point and continues to grow. I feel like I still, you know, the site launched 12 years ago, but it's really been 13 years that we've been working on it. And I still am really excited to work on it every day. I'm having a really good time. And there's still like just a ridiculously long list of things we want to do to improve it, to help artists succeed at a bigger and bigger scale. And so there's just, it feels like there's no end in sight to that. But yeah.
I love that. And I, you know, I feel it's because you've clearly really stayed true to your mission, you know, and not gotten too off base there. It's like, okay, this is the problem we're trying to solve. We're trying to help artists. We're not necessarily trying to take over the world. And in the meantime, you've paid out, you know, coming up on $700 million to artists and rights holders. So that's amazing. That's awesome to hear. You're super excited, you know, to work on this every day. How has your life changed, you know, since 2000, 2008 because of Bandcamp success, or has it?
It hasn't. I'm still doing pretty much the exact same thing, as in 2007, 2008. I don't know. I mean, obviously it's changed a lot in the last year. Bandcamp in the last year has gotten, I think, more publicity, more press than we did in the first 11 years combined. And, you know, that's because of the pandemic. I think we were just really fortunate in that, you know, what we've been working on, all this time has been something that, was even more useful, in a pandemic, right? Where, artists found themselves in this position where, you know, suddenly a big part of their income was gone, couldn't tour anymore, and needed to really turn to their fans and say, "Look, this is a way to directly support me," and we were there. So, you know, to me, this last year has felt like the biggest change in Bandcamp, and but it's all been, you know, all been for the better, and I just feel really lucky that we ended up being in a position to help out artists at a time that really was pretty horrible for a lot of people.
Absolutely. And for those that don't know, share what Bandcamp Fridays are and some of the charity components you guys built in 2020.
Oh, sure. So when the pandemic hit and we realized artists were having this problem, and, you know, this is our community, right? This is, Bandcamp would not exist without all of the artists and labels on the site, obviously. So we wanted to figure out like what it is that we could do to help. And then we talked about it a bunch and decided on this pretty simple idea, which is that we were just going to try waiving our revenue share completely and see what would happen. And so we announced that, sent a message to all of our artists that we were going to do this. And the response from artists was, and labels both, was really amazing. What happened was the artists, a lot of them said to their fans, "Hey, this is a way to directly support me." A lot of them said, "Hey, Bandcamp's waiving their fee on this day. And on this day, I'm actually going to send all of the money that I make to this organization, this food bank," and a lot of labels came forward and said, "You know what, we're going to waive our share of this on this day as well and pass it on directly to artists." So, you know, the biggest day that we had up until then was a day that we had done a fundraiser for the ACLU. And that was $1 million in one day. Wow. And on the first day that we did this fee waiver, it was $4 million in a single day. So, you know, it was really, the site was definitely under a lot of stress that day. Our support team, our systems team, our developers were all scrambling to respond to the surge that happened. And then because it was so successful, we did it again. And we did it again about a month later. And that time, it was $7 million in a day. And, then we decided, okay, we're just going to keep doing this until the end of the pandemic. And people on Twitter started calling it Bandcamp Friday. So we picked that up, and used that, you know, same terminology in our announcements. And, we've done 11 of these so far, and they've made, in those 11 days, they've made, all close to now $50 million for artists just from those 11 days. And, you know, in the meantime, of course, every other day on Bandcamp, people are selling, you know, fans are buying music directly from artists. So it's now about $21 million a month that fans are paying artists. But on those individual Bandcamp Fridays, it's, you know, a big spike still. And, you know, it's just, it's exciting to see, you know, especially like seeing a label passing on all of their revenue to artists. Really quite amazing. Because these aren't, you know, we're not talking about like Warner or Sony or you know, Universal. These are like, a lot of these are just essentially small businesses, right? And so I think that that sort of, you know, that sort of behavior from our, from people is just really heartening to see. And obviously, you know, the small businesses, the labels, they need the money too. So it's important, you know, it's important, I think, to support artists and labels like every day on Bandcamp if you love the music. And the thing, you know, the stat that I like to remind people of is like, when you do on, when you buy music on Bandcamp Friday, it's about 93% that ends up going to the artist or label, because that's after, you know, processing fees from the credit card companies. But if you buy music on another day, as I said before, the average ends up being 82%, right? So it's not a huge difference. Like, so every day, basically, it's a good day to directly support the artists and labels who you love.
And again, you know, when the fan opts in, the artists and rights holder get the data as well, which to me is just as powerful as these very impressive numbers. And again, I just want to, you know, reiterate, like, you know, not to get too into it unless you want to, I it's just so impressive that you guys have stayed private, because, you know, you're sharing these really impressive numbers, and you can be successful and you can support artists and you can raise money for charity, and you don't have to, you're not beholden to anyone else, you know, like you're not beholden to, you know, just crazy growth numbers. And like I said, trying to take over the world, you've stayed true to your core mission and values instead of jumping around. And, yeah, I think that's a huge reason why, well, besides everything that you're saying, why you guys are so trusted and so beloved by artists. So it's, I mean, if you want to add anything to that, you can. It wasn't really a question.
Well, it feels good to hear that. Maybe that's the only thing I can say.
Cool. Well, we touched on this a little bit, but it's 2021. And once in a while, I still come across a label that will not allow us to distribute artists' music on Bandcamp. Do you care? And if so, what points do you make as to why labels music should be on Bandcamp? Because again, for context for people, you know, when you started, the argument, the quote unquote argument would be, you know, the labels are fighting for like iTunes chart placements and, in my opinion, crap like that. And now it's, oh, but that might take away Spotify streams. So like I said, when, you know, if I'm coming across these labels, I'm sure you are. So do you care when you come up against that? And like I said, what points do you make as to why labels music should be on Bandcamp?
Well, we want anybody to be on Bandcamp. We want anybody to be able to be on Bandcamp who wants to be, right? There's nobody that I would say, oh, I don't want their music to be on Bandcamp. Sure. Unless, I mean, outside of obviously like terms of use violations and things like that. Right. But we want to enable that. But the issue really is that, you know, you have to in order to put your music up on Bandcamp, right, you have to agree to our terms and you have to own or control all of the necessary rights. And there are definitely some people, like if you have signed an exclusive agreement with a performance rights organization, who can't do that. So we want to enable that. And we're working towards that. It's a slow process. It's something that we've been working on actually for a long time. But you know, those organizations and Bandcamp are completely aligned, right? We all want to get help artists and help artists get paid. So that's a sort of, I would say, just a longer term goal that we've had, and it's coming.
Yeah, awesome. And again, in my world, it's amazing how, when I share that you've paid out $400 million or $500 million or now $700 million, I've gotten labels to care.
Right.
So keep up the great work.
Thank you.
Another audience question from Culla, who's an artist. Do you see monetization for streaming happening on Bandcamp at any point? And obviously when a fan buys music, you know, they can stream it, or, you know, the artist slash rights holder has the choice on, you know, if they're making their streaming available. But yeah, are you able to share any thoughts on that?
Sure. Well, I mean, the way I see it is streaming is monetized on Bandcamp. Streaming is how people listen to music on the site to discover whether or not they want to buy it. And we've looked at, we've done an analysis and found that, you know, the sort of effect, if you look at the amount of streaming that happens on the site in terms of the amount of money that it generates in sales, the sort of effective revenue per stream that happens on the site is something like 40 times the amount that, you know, is typically talked about for streaming services.
Totally.
Now, if what we did, and if I thought, oh, you know, it would be actually better for artists if what we did instead is like lock that all down into a subscription service and try to compete with Apple Music, Spotify, and so on, I would do that. But I think that would end up being much worse for musicians based on, you know, the analysis that we've done.
Interesting. Very cool. Couple more questions. Where is Bandcamp going?
Sure. Well, you know, I think this idea of making it really, really easy for fans to directly support artists and for artists to offer fans ways to support them is, as a general concept, supports, you know, so many different things, right? So some of that so far for Bandcamp has been, you know, buying digital music or buying physical goods. We've just recently launched Bandcamp Live, which allows you to stream a show and have an integrated merch table, and people sell tickets to that. We just had an artist do a show the other day that sold $30,000 in tickets. Right. So, you know, we want to just enable those kinds of things, you know, and there's so many of them. Yeah, another one is our vinyl pressing service that we just recently launched as well, or have started to roll out at a much bigger scale anyway. And that, you know, it comes out of an observation that, you know, the people who sell physical goods through the site make much more money than people who sell digital only. And vinyl is, you know, the number one, it's the number one physical good that's sold through Bandcamp. So we wanted to enable a lot more artists to offer that. But it's been really challenging, I think, for artists to do that, because, you know, not only do you have to come up with thousands of dollars, so it's risky, but it's also just requires a lot of expertise that not everybody has. So we wanted to make something like that really, really easy. So we've launched this this pressing service where you can basically go to your fans and crowdfund the necessary money to press the record. And then Bandcamp takes care of the coordination of the pressing. And then we do all the fulfillment and all the customer service, all the things that would really, all those barriers that I think prevent artists from offering something like that. So we want to do that. I, you know, as a general idea, that's where we're going, like make it as easy as possible for artists to offer fans things like that, and make it really, really easy for fans to support artists in that way.
That's so great. I love that. Thanks again for listening to today's podcast episode. Before we wrap up and I ask possibly the most fundamental question of this entire podcast, I just wanted to remind you that today's podcast is brought to you by our friends at Bandzoogle. Built by musicians for musicians, Bandzoogle is an all-in-one platform that makes it easy to build a stunning website and EPK for your music. And just to add some editorial to that, I mean, obviously there's plenty of website platforms out there, but it's so nice to work with one that's specifically designed for musicians and what you're doing. All the features you need for a professional website are already built in, including dozens of fully customizable templates. So if you don't know how to code or you don't know graphic design, like me, I'm saying I don't know graphic design at all. It's nice to have those templates. Tools to sell your music and merch commission free. That's super huge that it's commission free. I don't know anyone else that does that. Commission free crowdfunding and fan subscription features. That's also super nice because, again, I don't know any sort of crowdsource or subscription outlets that don't charge a commission. Mailing list tools to grow your fan list and send newsletters, and integrations with Bandcamp, SoundCloud, YouTube, Bands in Town, and more, so you can easily add content from your other online profiles. And again, that's super nice. You know, you can sell your Bandcamp, your music via Bandcamp directly, embed your YouTube videos. I know artists really love Bands in Town for live shows, so that's all super handy. And I would say, like, fundamentally, you know, I don't want to say like more important than those other things, but they have live support from their musician friendly team 7 days a week. So again, if you have questions, it's really nice to talk to someone who understands what you're going through and not just like answering calls from, you know, people also building websites for their restaurants or whatever. Plans start at just $8.29 per month, which includes hosting and your own free custom domain name. How to Build a Sustainable Music Career and Collect All Revenue Streams podcast listeners, that's you, can go to Banzoogle.com to try it free for 30 days and use the promo code SUSTAINABLE, SUSTAINABLE, to get 15% off the first year of any subscription. That's Banzoogle.com, promo code SUSTAINABLE. If you want to check the spelling, you can Google that word. So thanks again for listening, and we're going to wrap up right now. Finally, what does building a sustainable music career mean to you?
You mean, well, I'm not an artist myself, but, you know, building a sustainable music career, I would say it means being able to continue creating music, doing what you want to do, and going, I think to do that, you know, you should be using every avenue you have available. And, you know, I think of Bandcamp as just, it's obviously just one of those avenues. Obviously it's the one that I would love to see as many people using as possible, but there are loads of others. I feel like people should be exploring everything that's out there and taking advantage of all the tools. I mean, it's so different than when Bandcamp started, right? There actually are lots of other, I think, ways for people to get their music out there and be directly supported by their fans. And so I think it's just about looking for all those ways and listening to podcasts like yours.
Thank you.
How about that?
but your, you know, what you just said, like, you know, having a career forever, it's like that's what you guys do. That's what Bandcamp does. Like, you know, I've always felt that, or I've always built my career this way, and I feel the industry should be this way, and I feel like Bandcamp is this way. Put the artists first. Take care of fans a very close second, and give artists access to fan data so we can build those relationships and grow it forever. So thank you for everything that you have done for so many artists and are continuing to do. Is there anything you want to add in general?
No, I think, yeah, that's, I feel like we've covered a lot of it, and yeah, I really appreciate the opportunity to come on the show and talk about it a little bit. It's really fun.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Ethan, for taking the time. And again, thank you for everything you guys have done and are doing for artists, for charity, sharing data with artists. It's just amazing. I'm in awe.
Thanks, Emily.
Absolutely. So that's a wrap for this episode of How to Build a Sustainable Music Career and Collect All Revenue Streams. Tune in next week, where we're going to continue talking about setting up your release and distribution plan and how you get your music on Spotify and all of that. But you start with Bandcamp, and I'm not just saying that. That's why we're going in order here. So thank you again, Ethan, and everyone out there, have an awesome day, night, wherever you are, and we'll catch you next.